question and answer night, which we have on the third Sunday night of the month. And this time I have a bunch of questions on the subject of fasting, which I was asked to address. So that is what we will be talking about in tonight's Q&A session. And the questions are, first, is fasting, as discussed, and there's a parentheses, instructed, question mark, in the Bible, is fasting, as discussed in the Bible, for today? If so, and here are the follow-up questions, how should we go about fasting in practical terms? Is there a specific length of time? What does one do when fasting besides not eating? Do you fast while going about regular daily activities or set aside quiet time? Now, because the subsequent four questions are all based on an affirmative answer to the first question, you know, we could actually make this whole thing much simpler by just saying no to the first one, but that's not what we're going to do. Is fasting, as discussed or instructed in the Bible, for today? Well, you know, there's a lot of misinformation that circulates about the subject of fasting. Perhaps, I think, number one at the top of the list of wrong things that people say is that it was just an Old Testament thing. But that's actually not true. There's no evidence that fasting was something intrinsic to the Mosaic Covenant. In fact, fasting is only talked about once in the Law of Moses, and it's not called fasting. It's called humbling your souls. There was a requirement that the people were to humble their souls on the Day of Atonement, the 10th day of the 7th month. And, you know, you can argue about what humble your souls mean. And I've heard people who try to argue that it doesn't mean fasting. But the fact is that the expression means fasting almost everywhere else it appears in the Old Testament, and it's clearly idiomatic for that. I can provide references if people have questions about the linguistics of that. But I don't want to get too hung up on that. I would also note that Acts 27, verse 9, whenever Paul is on his voyage to Rome, and it mentions an event that takes place called the fast. And it's referring, it's getting close to wintertime, and when the fast had been completed. And it's clearly in that context idiomatic, again, for the Day of Atonement. The fast being a recognition of that particular Jewish feast. But people fasted for all kinds of other reasons besides the Day of Atonement, and they did it both in the Old Testament and in the New Testament as well. So as far as is fasting for today, you got several things to look at. You have, of course, the example of Jesus himself, who fasted for 40 days in the wilderness, a long time. You know, I've heard some people say that Jesus' baptism is an example for us. I might wonder why his immediately subsequent fasting would not also be an example. But maybe that's a little bit much. I mean, he did a lot of stuff that we don't do today, like performing miracles and raising the dead and other things like that. So why not look at, let's look at some of his teaching, subject of fasting as well. And there are really two occasions where Jesus had something to say about the subject of fasting. One of them is in Matthew chapter 6. And that's in the context of the Sermon on the Mount. You would turn in your Bibles to Matthew 6. I mean, verses 16 through 18. Jesus says, "Whenever you fast, do not put on a gloomy face as the hypocrites do, but they neglect their appearance so that they will be noticed by men when they are fasting. Truly I say to you, they have their reward in full. But you, when you fast, anoint your head and wash your face, so that your fasting will not be noticed by men, but by your Father who is in secret, and your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you." Now, we need to appreciate the context of that statement. The Sermon on the Mount, it has a little bit of a paradox running through it, and there's a big question, should you let men see your good deeds or not? Because if you read Matthew chapter 5, you think the answer to that question is yes. If you read Matthew chapter 6, you think the answer to that question is no. In fact, Jesus makes two statements that sound kind of paradoxical. In Matthew 5:16, Jesus said, "Let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who's in heaven." But then in Matthew 6:1, he says, "Beware of practicing your righteousness before men to be noticed by them. Otherwise, you have no reward with your Father who is in heaven." Oh, is this some Bible contradiction? Should we let men see our good works or not? Well, no, it becomes clear that the distinguishing feature is, of course, motive. Who are you doing it to be seen by? You know, if your goal is to get people to glorify the Father who is in heaven, then yes, you should let your light shine before men. But if your goal is to get people to look at you and glorify yourself and say, oh, look at me, I'm such a righteous person. Look at him, he's so holy, he prays, he fasts, he gives to the poor. If that's your goal, to get people to say that about you, then you're doing it for the wrong reason. You're just doing it to be seen by them. And if you do that, then your reward is earthly and not heavenly. That's the basic point of Matthew chapter 6. Now in Matthew 6, we have this distinction between glorifying God and glorifying self. Jesus gives three warnings, and they're parallel to each other, surrounding three religious acts. Verses 2 through 4 talk about giving to the poor. When you give to the poor, do not sound a trumpet before you, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, so that they may be honored by men. Truly I say to you, they have their reward in full. When you give to the poor, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, so that your giving will be in secret, and your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. I was in a piano class once, and I quoted verse 3, and the teacher didn't consider that acceptable excuse for not having prepared the material for some reason. But the whole point is, you know, when you give to the poor, which is a good thing, you should do it, don't make a big effort to let other people know what you're doing. Keep it secret. Don't even let your right hand know what your left hand is doing. If you keep it secret, your reward won't be from the favor of men, it'll be the favor of God. Verses 5 through 15 deal with prayer and is much more extensive because it has Jesus' model prayer in it. But for our purposes, we'll look at verses 5 and 6. When you pray, you are not to be like the hypocrites, but they love to stand in the synagogues and on the street corners so that they may be seen by men. Truly I say to you, they have their reward in full. When you pray, go into your inner room, close your door, and pray to your Father who is in secret. Your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. So the problem here in verse 2, in verse 5, and in verse 16 is being seen by men. People who give to the poor to be seen by men. People who pray to be seen by men. People who fast to be seen by men. Jesus says that if they do these things to be seen by men, in all three instances, they have their reward in full. He says, but if you do it in secret, then your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. That's true of giving to the poor. That's true of praying. And that's true of fasting. So, just based on the surface meaning of what Jesus says, fasting can gain reward from God. We take that at face value. There's also another factor in how Jesus introduces each statement. Whenever you give to the poor. Anybody here think that giving to the poor, that giving alms, is optional for Christians? It's not. What about praying? When you pray, is praying optional for Christians? It's not. We're going to be consistent in our interpretation then. We come to whenever you fast. Is fasting optional for Christians? This is where it's difficult. Jesus' teaching assumes that we will give to the poor, assumes that we will pray, and assumes that we will fast. Now, there's a lot of discussion that we can have about how we give to the poor. People have a lot of conversations about, you know, how much to give, how often to give, what context to give in, when not to give. There's a lot of discussion about prayer. How often to pray, how to pray, what sorts of things to pray for, all of these different ideas. In fact, we talked quite a bit about prayer this morning when we were looking at Daniel 9 and some of the different things we could learn for prayer. When you fast. Fasting is, I don't know about you, maybe my experience is different from everybody else's, but my experience was, in church, growing up, that people did not talk about fasting at all. And it wasn't discussed very much, and if you ever brought it up, people kind of got all, you know, you're not supposed to talk about fasting because you're doing that to be seen by men. And I just, in the back of my head, I'm thinking to myself, that doesn't actually make sense because, you know, we have public prayer. And we have public prayer all the time. Nobody sees Jesus' instructions on prayer. Do it in secret. Do it so that no one will see you. Nobody sees that as a prohibition on public prayer. We understand there's a context to that. But all of a sudden with fasting, it's like, can't talk about fasting in church. And that's not an appropriate way to reason through that passage. If we're being consistent, we have to assume Jesus' teaching assumes that we will fast at some point as Christians. The only discussion is when and how. Now, Let's look at the other passage. I said there were two major places in Jesus' teaching where he talks about fasting. That was one. Let's look at the other one, Matthew chapter 9. Matthew chapter 9, and pick up in verse 14. The disciples of John came to him asking, "Why do we and the Pharisees fast, but your disciples do not fast?" Jesus said to them, "The attendants of the bridegroom cannot mourn as long as the bridegroom is with them, can they? But the days will come when the bridegroom is taken away from them, and then they will fast. But no one puts a patch of unshrunk cloth on an old garment, for the patch pulls away from the garment, and a worse tear results. Nor do people put new wine into old wineskins, otherwise the wineskins burst, and the wine pours out, and the wineskins are ruined. But they put new wine into fresh wineskins, and both are preserved." Okay. Now that basic story appears in Mark chapter 2 and in Luke chapter 5 as well. So it's in three of the four Gospels. It always appears sequentially after Jesus has been invited into Matthew the tax collector's house, and after he's given that whole speech about how it's not the healthy who need a doctor, it's the sick. And the question posed to Jesus is, how come we fast and you don't? Because it was customary to fast a bunch back then. The Pharisees liked to fast every Monday and Thursday. In fact, this is referenced in Luke 18 and verse 12 in the parable of the Pharisee and the publican, when the Pharisee is praying and he says in that prayer, "I fast twice a week, I pay tithes of all that I get." Jesus' main response, he says, is that we don't have a reason to fast. And that's the idea here, basically. The reason we're not fasting is because we don't have a reason to fast. There's no point in fasting right now. And in fact, he equates it with mourning, if you look at it. The attendants of the bridegroom cannot mourn as long as the bridegroom is with them, but the days will come when the bridegroom is taken away, and then they will fast. Fasting and mourning are used interchangeably in this passage. The bridegroom, while he's with the people, they have a reason to be happy, joyful. You don't fast in times of joy. I mean, Jesus, he wasn't known as somebody who went around fasting a bunch outside of his one situation in the wilderness, his temptation. The Son of Man came eating and drinking. He was accused of being a gluttonous man and a wine bibber. You got that to work with. But the bridegroom is a source of joy and peace. Fasting ought to be appropriate to the occasion. In the Old Testament, there's an oracle by the prophet Zechariah in Zechariah 7 and 8. Which for want of time we will not read this evening, but I highly, highly encourage you to read it, where Zechariah again talks about the need for fasting to be appropriate to the occasion and how the people are engaging in this ritual fasting, thinking they're doing it for the Lord, but they're really not. Eventually, Jesus says the bridegroom will be absent, and then the disciples will fast. Now, when's the bridegroom absent? Huh? Before the wedding? Absent before. He just darts off before the wedding. Is the bridegroom present with us right now? Yes. And yet there's a sense in which we're still waiting. And in fact, we're going to see that after the ascension, Christians did fast. There's a couple of instances of this in the book of Acts they would engage in. The point that Jesus is making is that fasting is not supposed to be a mindless ritual. It needs to be done with purpose. And if you don't have a good reason to fast, then don't do it. Since Jesus is not currently with us on the earth, there's a sense, I guess, in which he's spiritually, he dwells within us, you have Christ in you, you eat the Lord's Supper with us, all those types of things. But we're still, in another sense, Jesus is not with us. We're waiting for him to come back. He's ascended to heaven, and we're waiting for him to return. Yes, Jen? I have no idea. I don't know if I'd take that analogy to that point, but okay. we're waiting for the discovery of the Son, his return from the heaven. There's the whole discussion we could have about that, I'm sure. But we long for the bridegroom's return. He's not here, and we are kind of like, hey, when's he going to come back? My son even asked today while we were driving in the car, he's like, why is Jesus taking so long to come back?
Oh, yeah.
No, he's 5 years old, he asked that. But it's a... Sometimes you look at the world around you and you really ask that question. Why, when, you know, wish he'd come back now and get it over with. I told John that, you know, well, he's patient towards us, waiting for us to, waiting for people to repent, basically. 2 Peter 3. It was, but, I mean, could we, there's a sense in which, of course, since he's not back yet, we're grieving his absence. We grieve the suffering that's in the world. We grieve the loss of loved ones. And we grieve a lot. We have a lot of reasons to be sorrowful while we're separated. Of course, our sorrow will eventually be turned to joy. But could one conceivably find reasons to fast today? Well, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, so is fasting for today? That answers the first question. Yes, fasting is for today. But now let's look at some of the examples of... Because, you know, I mean, we like to, you know, give book, chapter, and verse for stuff. Let's give some books, chapters, and verses of apostolic examples, approved apostolic examples of people fasting. In Acts chapter 13, in verses 1 through 3, there were at Antioch, in the church that was there, prophets and teachers, Barnabas and Simeon, who was called Niger, and Lucius of Cyrene, and Manaen, who had been brought up with Herod the Tetrarch, and Saul. While they were ministering to the Lord and fasting, the Holy Spirit said, "Set apart for me Barnabas and Saul for the work to which I have called them." Then, when they had fasted and prayed and laid their hands on them, they sent them away. All right, so you get two things about. You get two for the price of one here. First, people are fasting as part of their ongoing work at this congregation in Antioch in Acts 13, verse 2. But secondly, a more specific instance, a more specific occasion that prompts fasting is we're going to send out Paul and Barnabas to go preach in another area. This was considered a very important thing to pray. You know, while they were praying on their behalf, you're going to go preach in the churches in the Asia Minor region, the Galatian region, Cyprus, all these places. Before you send them out, before the congregation sends them out, they fast together. Would it be appropriate to fast today whenever we send out workers to another place? That's something to think about. Certainly. Yeah, they also had laying on of hands. You know, we don't see that much anymore either, do we? That'd be something to think about. I know some congregations that practice, you know, whenever they appoint elders or something, they lay hands on them. That's not something I see a lot of in churches. Speaking of appointing elders, next chapter. Chapter 14, Acts 14. Paul and Barnabas are going back through the churches they've established in Galatia. In verse 23, it says that when they had appointed elders for them in every church, having prayed with fasting, they commended them to the Lord in whom they believed. They've gone through these churches, they've appointed elders, and they apparently fasted in connection with the appointment of elders in the Galatian churches. Whenever they engaged in the serious task of appointing elders, they fasted. And we know it's important to pray before you appoint elders. Paul and Barnabas thought it so serious that they fasted as well. Now, both of these examples that we've given, Acts 13 and Acts 14, do they look like they are, you know, just one guy deciding to fast by himself, or do they look like it's more of a congregational deal? Group, yeah, it looks like it's a group activity here. Which skewers another idea I sometimes hear bouted around. You know, fasting is primarily an individual thing. Yes, there are instances in the Bible of individuals fasting by themselves, and there are also examples in the Bible of congregations fasting. You have apostolic examples on that point. So, you know, what do we make of that? You know, you've got these examples here. Now, technically, you don't have a divine oracle handed down from on high that says, you know, you must fast every time you appoint elders. But to be fair, you could apply all of the same logic, and more so, to Acts 20, verse 7, and the whole thing about first day of the week, Lord's Supper observance. So do what you will with that. I think we need to be consistent in our hermeneutics. In 2 Corinthians, Paul mentions fasting in the context of his apostolic suffering as well. Although the New American Standard doesn't translate it fasting, it translates it like hunger or something. in beatings and he lists a bunch of stuff he's suffering as an apostle. 2 Corinthians 6:5, in beatings and imprisonments and tumults and labors and sleeplessness, in hunger, or some versions say in fastings. Again, in 2 Corinthians 11:27, Paul says, I've been in labor and hardship through many sleepless nights, in hunger and thirst, often without food, in cold and exposure. Which you might wonder, like, why did he say hunger and then say he was without food? Well, you know, because the word for hunger there is actually the word fasting. There's also a textual variant, and probably not part of the original text, but in 1 Corinthians 7:5, that suggests that when a husband and wife are to set aside time to abstain, and this is a purely voluntary thing, some variants also include that they would fast together at that select time as well. Okay, so, you know, you've got quite a bit of evidence in the New Testament for congregational fasting, which leads me to conclude that, yes, it is for today. Although, the exact when's, how's, how do we go about it in practical terms? Only somebody would have submitted a question about that. Oh, wait. that was the next question. And if anybody has any comments or questions or just outright objections to things I say, by all means, you know, raise your hand. We can talk about this. This is more of an open forum type setting. Of course, the inevitable question arises, you know, how... And somebody, I brought up fasting one time, and somebody said, how would you enforce something like that? And that's a good question. So let's turn it on something else. How do you enforce something like prayer? Anybody know? You can't, ultimately. You know, a lot of God's instructions, a lot of God's expectations are kind of here's the instruction, go about it as you see fit. You know, I mean, there's not a specific... God didn't give a specific list of times that you're supposed to pray. He didn't give a specific duration of prayers that you had to have. He did say pray without ceasing. But, I mean, the point of that is not, you know, you should be praying every second of every day. You can't eat, you can't sleep, you can't do anything else. But the point is, don't stop praying. And, you know, we just kind of expect that brethren will pray. We don't, you know, knock down their doors every week. You know, did you remember to pray like we told you to? Well, no, we leave it to their own free will to figure this stuff like that out. Sometimes as a congregation, we will make an announcement and say, you know, this person needs your prayers. This person wants you to pray for them. We would like you to pray for this issue. And those are perfectly fine, perfectly acceptable to say. As a congregation, you can do that. Yeah, I mean, would there be occasion for the congregation to also say, hey, you know, we have a very serious decision coming up, we have a very serious issue coming up. Maybe if we were in the process of appointing elders, or maybe we, you know, we're in the process of sending out someone to go preach in a foreign land, you know, we would just want to ask the congregation to pray and to fast on behalf of them. Set aside some time to do that. It would also be an appropriate thing to ask for as well. Now, I'll come back to culture in a little bit because culture is so explosive. Okay. You know, I mean, and you got other objections as well that we can go about. But let's talk about practical terms. What is fasting? I've said fasting a bunch, but I haven't defined it. What is fasting? Abstaining from food. Absence of food, basically. Fasting is when you voluntarily abstain from food for a set amount of time. Fasting is not, I forgot to eat. Anybody ever done that? No? I've done that. That's a... Huh? You didn't call it fasting. Fasting isn't, I forgot to eat. You know, you did it on purpose. Fasting isn't, I'm only going to eat fruit, although you meet some creative people that say that. If you only want to eat fruit, that's fine, I guess. You call it fasting. Don't call it fasting. Oh, okay. Some people might call it fasting, I guess. Yes, Gail. Huh? Is it abstaining from... Well, you know, I mean, it appears that sometimes people drank water when they fasted, and sometimes they didn't. You know, and you have instances of that. The human body can survive an extremely long amount of time without food, as long as you keep it hydrated. If you deprive yourself of food and water, you'll die. Although Moses apparently didn't drink water for 40 days, didn't eat or drink anything, and he survived that. So, you know, maybe there'd be some kind of supernatural intervention, something like that. water appears to have been an option, I guess. But sometimes they go without that even. Fasting is not the time between meals. You know, and I've always got that one person, and every time I talk about fasting, there's always that one person that makes that joke about how, you know, I'm currently fasting, and I've been fasting since my last meal, and I'll be fasting until my next meal. That's what breakfast means. You break your fast. And while that does fit with the etymology of the English word breakfast, I guess it's not really what the Bible means, and that etymology doesn't exist in the Bible. It's an English thing. Fasting is when you purposefully leave food out. Yeah. For whatever reason. Now, what were the reasons people fasted? Why do people fast? Okay, they have a big decision to make. We saw that with the appointment of elders, certainly. Mourning is a big one. Like when Saul died, David and his men, they would fast to mourn the dead, to mourn Saul and Jonathan, 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel. The Day of Atonement is, of course, the fast that was commanded in the Law of Moses. Yes? Correct. Esther called for fasting in Esther chapter 4. Why did she call for fasting? Before a big decision. She had a big decision to make, right? Yeah. She's probably praying, but the book of Esther goes out of its way to never mention prayer or God or anything religious. Which is a whole other discussion on why Esther is written the way it is. But she was probably praying. You know, that's what was going on when Esther fasted. And the reason why is because, you know, she's going into the king. She faces certain death if the king decides he doesn't approve of her being there. So she fasts for 3 days. She has all these other people fast with her. And then she goes into the king. And in fact, fasting is frequently accompanied by... praying, right. It wasn't just, even the big decision, it was the praying that comes with it. 2 Samuel 12, whenever David's child becomes deathly ill, and he starts fasting and praying for 7 days, he prays that the Lord will heal the child. Then the child dies, and then David does something bizarre. He stops fasting, which most people fast after their child is dead. David doesn't. It's considered very unusual. Ezra chapter 8, whenever they're about to make the long journey back to the promised land, Ezra has not requested any assistance from Artaxerxes. The people, they fast and they pray before they make that journey. They petition that God will keep them safe. Fasting is sometimes also used in the context of repentance or sorrow for sin. You may remember, of course, this morning when if you were in the Daniel class, Daniel chapter 9, what was Daniel doing before he prayed that big lavish prayer of confession for sin? He was fasting. And he fasts again in Daniel chapter 10, right before he has this big apocalyptic type vision. But we'll say more about that when we get to Daniel chapter 10. Some other instances, of course. Joel describes fasting in congregational fashion. Whenever the people have been afflicted by a giant locust plague, all their crops have been eaten up, Joel tells the people to come to the temple to fast, which... kind of interesting. It's like, you don't have any food. You're not going to eat anyway. So come to the temple and fast. And, Joel chapter 1 and verse 14. Consecrate a fast, proclaim a solemn assembly, gather the elders and all the inhabitants of the land, the house of the Lord your God, and cry out to the Lord. And again in Joel 2, in verse 12 and 13, and even now declares the Lord, return to me with all your heart, and with fasting, weeping, and mourning, and rend your heart and not your garments. Now return to the Lord your God, for he is gracious and compassionate, slow to anger, abounding in loving kindness, and relenting of evil. Who knows whether he will not turn and relent and leave a blessing behind him, even a grain offering and a drink offering for the Lord your God. Also, Luke chapter 2, Anna, the prophetess, lived in the temple, said that she served the Lord with prayers and fastings. So apparently fasting was an act of worship on her part. So you got all these things, adding weight to a serious petition, mourning, expressing sorrow for sin. You don't see people fasting because they were happy. You don't see people fasting because they're thankful or because they're joyful. You see people fasting because they're sad or sorrowful about something, or because they've got a very, you know, perhaps nerve-wracking decision coming up. Fasting wasn't something you did to celebrate. Was fasting prone to abuse? Yeah, people did it for show all the time. They had a lot of commemorative fasts in Judaism. Like they would fast to commemorate the destruction of the temple in Zechariah 7. So they go to Zechariah after the temple's been rebuilt, and they're like, ooh, should we keep doing that fasting thing? Zechariah says, you haven't been eating for the Lord in captivity. What makes you think you were fasting for him? You were just keeping it as this mindless ritual. Isaiah 58 also contains a rather lengthy polemic telling the people, if they want to fast, they should try giving their bread to the poor. Isaiah 58, the people, I'll just read this. Cry loudly, do not hold back. Raise your voice like a trumpet and declare to my people their transgression and to the house of Jacob their sins. Yet they seek me day by day and delight to know my ways, as a nation that has done righteousness and has not forsaken the ordinance of their God. They ask me for just decisions. They delight in the nearness of God. Why have we fasted and you do not see? Why have we humbled ourselves and you do not notice? There's that idiom, humbling the soul. Behold, on the day of your fast, you find your desire and drive hard all your workers. Behold, you fast for contention and strife and to strike with a wicked fist. You do not fast like you do today to make your voice heard on high. Is it a fast like this which I should choose, a day for a man to humble himself? Is it for bowing one's head like a reed and for spreading out sackcloth and ashes as a bed? Will you call this a fast, even an acceptable day to the Lord? Is this not the fast which I choose? To loosen the bonds of wickedness, to undo the bands of the yoke, to let the oppressed go free and break every yoke? Is it not to divide your bread with the hungry and bring the homeless poor into the house when you see the naked to cover him and not to hide yourself from your own flesh? And he goes on. This is a rather lengthy diatribe. The whole point is, if you're going to fast, don't mistreat other people while you're doing it. It's not gaining any favor with God if you're going out and being a bad person. You know, or if you're mistreating the poor, or if you see a hungry man, to not feed him. Well, no, you're supposed to feed the hungry. You're not going to eat. You might as well give your food to him. There's that point here. But fasting is not alone in being prone to abuse. I mean, people abuse giving to the poor. People abuse prayer. People abuse all kinds of acts of worship here and there. The solution isn't to stop doing the thing. The solution is to stop doing the abuse. You know, if people in an assembly of God are praying in an ungodly way, the solution isn't to stop praying. The solution is to stop being ungodly. We got that. Just when we talk about going about fasting in practical terms, the occasion should merit it. And, you know, we should talk about, I mean, we should look for occasions that are appropriate. Like if we're mourning something bad that's happened, the loss of a loved one or something sorrowful. Or if we're making a particularly serious prayer and we deem that it is an occasion that we should also fast to accompany said prayer, that would be appropriate. But a lot of that's left to your judgment call. There's a cultural quirk here. In the ancient world, a couple of cultural quirks. First of all, in the ancient world, when people died, it was customary to fast to mourn them. Today, when people die, what happens? We feed them. People bring food over. How many funerals have you been to where, so-and-so, the family will invite you over to their house to have food afterwards? Food is served, like, in connection with almost every funeral I've ever been to. We invite each other out to eat. We invite each other over to eat. We do all these other things. That's been my experience in this culture. So, I guess, I guess our culture is different from theirs. But the other thing to be mindful of is how much ancient culture really revolves around food prep. If you spend 90% of your day preparing your meal, and then you decide, I'm not going to eat today, what just happened to your daily schedule? You've got a big gap. You've got a lot of time on your hands all of a sudden. What are you going to do with that free time? Do you think they watch TV? No? Do you think they... Yeah. Papa's day is no different. Haha, well, Papa had to go out and work in the field, that's true, but that's a... No. Well, there is also the Sabbath, the kind of a counterpart to that as well. I mean, what was the whole point of the Sabbath? It was to say, you know, we don't work on this day. What am I going to do with my Sabbath? That's a good point to bring up. I mean, it's, you know. Right. Well, it's something to think about, certainly. I guess that'll only be true for your mama. You're right. But it's, all right. Luck. Jen, you have something? Well, what was the point? Well, first of all, the Pharisees probably didn't spend a lot of time working in the fields because, you know, they were Pharisees. They were educated people who spent all their time studying books and things. Usually. But, you know, the other aspect of all that is, you know, when you talk about, I lost my train of thought. I mean, you know, as far, the other thing, of course, is that, why do you work? Why, in the ancient world, why did you work? Why did you go to work? To eat, right? Exactly. You gotta pay your day's wages so that you can eat your daily bread. If you're not gonna eat that day, I guess you could do some more work and catch, you know, get ahead on money or something like that, but, you know, I mean, you're part of your motivation to work is gone because, again, you still have to eat. Okay, so the point, I mean, of course, you know, your schedule has been changed just by very nature of the fact that you're fasting. And it's unlikely that you spent that time watching TV or playing Pictionary or, you know, whatever it is. You know, what would you do? Supposed to be praying. You know, maybe you meditate on the Word of God or pray. In some ways, fasting does, even though fasting is not the Sabbath, fasting does serve a similar purpose to the Sabbath. And in fact, in Isaiah 58, he goes without missing a beat. He skips from talking about fasting to talking about the Sabbath in verses 13 and 14. You know, because of the Sabbath, you turn your foot from doing your pleasure on my holy day and call the Sabbath a delight, the holy day of the Lord honorable, and honor it, desisting from your own ways, from seeking your own pleasure, and speaking your own word, and you will take delight in the Lord. The whole point of the Sabbath is, you know, don't seek your own pleasure, seek the Lord. The whole point of fasting, don't seek your own pleasure, seek the Lord. In fact, the Day of Atonement not only required fasting, but it required abstention from work as well. That was also involved in it. And so, I mean, you know, we do have to appreciate that, you know, even though, I mean, Mama in the kitchen and Dada in the field's roles are different, you know, it wasn't exactly like skipping your 45-minute lunch break. It wasn't exactly like that. You know, there was something. It's like, you know, I'm going to eliminate my morning schedule and focus on God's word or what God has done. And if we decide to fast today, it probably needs to be with some kind of spiritual focus in mind. It might demand that we not work, or at least we take a few hours off, or something like that. But again, so much of that's discretionary because there are no specific instructions. There are no specific... It's just like prayer, you know. Could you take time off work to go pray? Sure. Would that be beneficial sometime? Oh, yeah. Should you do it all the time? Probably not. You might not have work for a while. You know, but those are some things to think about. Which again brings us to another question. Is there a specific length of time? And since we've analogized it to prayer already, we might as well ask, you know, I mean, is there a specific length of time you need to pray? Without ceasing. Okay, well, obviously, prayer and fasting are not the same in that respect. Because if you fast without ceasing, what happens? Yeah, you die. Okay, so that doesn't work. There's a lot of association between prayer and fasting, but they're not exactly the same. You know, I mean, for starters, you can pray for 10 seconds. I mean, you know, you look, read Nehemiah chapters 1 and 2. Nehemiah prays very quickly, silently. You know, the king asks him a question, he prays and immediately answers. You know, so you can do that with prayer. You can't do stuff like that with fasting. Because, you know, if you go without eating for only 10 seconds, you have a problem. Huh? Yeah, gluttony. There you go. Well, these two issues are more related than we think. I think this is the reason fasting is such a squeamish subject for people, is because we're very sensitive about our eating habits. I mean, people make their eating habits into status symbols. You know, I only eat meat. I only eat vegetables. I only do this. You know, I only eat the specific species of legume. Whatever it is, you know, we're very sensitive about food. And yeah. Well, I mean, essentially, you know, it's a certain adding of weight to petition. And I want to be careful how I state this. You know, I don't want to make it seem like, you know, if we fast, that'll automatically make God listen more, your prayer. Because, I mean, you could say the same thing about, you know, being persistent in prayer. If you pray for something and don't get it, the reason why isn't because, well, you didn't pray enough times. It's not like God has a magic quota. You know, if he prays 999 times for that, I'm not giving it to him. But if he gets to 1,000, then I'll give it to him. It's not like there's a magic formula. That's not how God operates. The point of prayer is to express reliance on God rather than reliance on self. To basically say, I don't know how to solve my problem, so I'm putting it in your hands. I'm looking to you for guidance because I'm not equipped to deal with this. You know, fasting is kind of the same way. It's basically saying, you know, I mean, the Lord knows what's in your heart, but it's a way of expressing oneself to God and saying, you know, I feel very strongly about this, so much so that I have decided to forego food and remind myself that you're actually the one that feeds me. And you're the one that is, I mean, it's like we said, you know, we sang before him, break the bread of life. The real bread we eat isn't the food that we put in our mouth. It's the, man doesn't live by just bread only. He lives by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. Something Jesus said in the wilderness while he was fasting. Also something God told Israel in the wilderness in Deuteronomy 8. You know, and so you have those types of things as well. In fact, you know, prayer, you can pray a very momentary thing. Fasting requires you to not live in the moment. Because in today's culture, it's so easy to snack on food when we get bored. You know, somebody leaves a sleeve of Girl Scout cookies laying out, and I tell you, I don't know how those things disappear so fast. It's I don't know who's doing it either in our house. But prayer is also more versatile than fasting, too, I would say. There are hundreds of reasons to pray. There are thousands of reasons to pray. You know, and there are happy occasions to pray. There are sad occasions to pray. There's all sorts of, a whole range of things. With fasting, there's not as many occasions where it is appropriate to fast. You can say almost any occasion is appropriate for prayer, but not every occasion is appropriate for fasting. And so there are some differences. Fasting requires, you know, more somber circumstances, sadder circumstances. You know, if we have a serious issue to pray about, then fasting would be good to connect with that. You know, if whether it be, you know, something the congregation does, like appointing elders, or whether it be something, you know, you have some decision you face as an individual, and it's really difficult, and you don't know what's going to glorify the Lord most, might consider fasting in connection with that. It's not like it's not a magic tool for getting what you want, but it does emphasize the seriousness of the occasion. I mean, you think about it, the people in the Bible who fasted the most are the people who we think of as having the most, well, the close, deep relationship with the Lord. Moses, Elijah, Jesus. Do you think they had a vivid awareness of how God sustains people? Do you think they were just doing it for show? Well, probably not. What does one do? Another question, what does one do when fasting besides not eating? Well, and there's a lot of, we've kind of touched on this already, there's a lot of possibilities. Prayer, meditating on the Word. Isaiah 58 suggests taking the food you were going to eat and giving it to the poor. Those are all good ideas to consider. Do you fast while going about regular daily activities or set aside quiet time? Well, you know, again, that's something that's probably super discretionary. You know, it's like trying to decide what prayer posture to use, you know? It's the Bible. In the Bible, when people pray, what are they typically doing? doing this. They're holding their hands up. You don't see a lot of people pray like that today, right? You know, most of the time, people pray with their hands folded, at least that I've seen. People used to kneel when praying. They don't do that as much anymore. And we could probably discuss slash argue at length about the merits and drawbacks of these changes. But the difference is a little bit cultural. People have made their devotion to God fit their cultural context. Culture's not binding. You're not required to follow it. I know of at least one church that decided to have a congregational fast when it was time to appoint elders. And then, another occasion, the same congregation, they had a member that was deathly ill, very sick, and she was near death. And again, they chose to fast on that occasion while they prayed on her behalf. And if you would ask them, well, why did you fast on that occasion? Why did you fast when appointing elders? Why did you fast for that? They would have pointed you to the scriptures, and they'd shown you all the other passages about this subject. I mean, you could ask questions, how would a congregational fast work? Would we meet together and agree, just we're all going to meet together, skip a meal today and pray? Will we make announcements, say we want you to pray and fast for so-and-so? There's a lot of alternatives. God left the specifics up to us. He leaves them up to us in fasting as well. That's kind of what I would get into. And one more thing, because you never run out of one more things with fasting. And that's this other, almost inevitably somebody brings up this question, what do you do if you're a person who has some debilitating medical condition that prevents you from going without food for a set time? Because I had somebody bring that up. He said, I can't fast, I'm diabetic, if I skip a meal, I go into the sugar coma or something like that. Insert any medical condition here. And really, the best answer I can come up with that is Luke 12:48. To whom much is given, much will be required. And if we're going to compare fasting to things like giving to the poor, praying, everybody can pray. Can everybody give to the poor? Not the same amount, that's for sure. You got the widow with her two mites, but once she's given that, what's she got left? Is she expected to give to the poor? No, is God saying, you didn't fulfill your almsgiving obligation? No. Is he going to crack down on that widow who has nothing to give? No. The whole point in 2 Corinthians 8 and 9, Paul says, I'm not asking you to impoverish yourselves. I'm asking you to attain some kind of equality here. Does God punish people for not doing something that they are physically incapable of doing? That I think is probably the simplest explanation that I could give for that. And I don't have much to add past that, except to say, the Lord has been provisional for people in the past and could be, again, because there are no specific regulations on how often or how long to fast, it's important that, of course, we don't try to bind those types of things on people as well. We're a little past the hour. Anybody have any other questions, observations, comments, things they want to share? That was not a fast summary, but it was waiting for the moment to use that joke. But I hope that this has been beneficial and maybe given us something to think about. I also avoided commenting on any medical drawbacks / benefits to fasting because I am not qualified to talk about that. So somebody else can do that research. But in all seriousness, I think that the biggest importance of fasting and the idea of going without food is to remind ourselves where our food comes from. To remind ourselves where our true sustenance comes from. The Lord provides us with a lavish banquet that He has prepared for us in heaven above. The Lord has provided us with the true bread of life in Jesus Christ, the true living water of life in the Spirit of our God whom He has poured out on us. In enduring things like physical hunger, physical thirst reminds us something. That's what's going on spiritually when we deprive ourselves of Christ, when we deprive ourselves of the Spirit, when we deprive ourselves of the Scriptures. So maybe fasting would be good just simply to remind ourselves what's going on inside of us whenever we go without this, whenever we malnourish ourselves, deprive ourselves of the Word. Or maybe there's someone here tonight who realizes that they have been depriving themselves, that they have not had the proper relationship with the Lord that they need to have. They need to make that right. And now is an appropriate time to let that be known. All together we stand and we sing the song selected.